You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Wednesday, December 15th, 2010, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
And Evan Bernstein.
Wow. There's an elephant in the room, and I didn't even know it.
Jay, what'd you eat for dinner?
Sorry. That's my didgeridoo.
I beg your pardon? This is a family show.
If my didgeridoo could make that noise, Evan, I would not be in this business.
Be doing a different kind of show.
Yeah, Steve and I bought didgeridoos when we were in Australia, and I've been literally practicing mine every single day. I have not missed a day yet.
Jay, explain what the hell they are.
A didgeridoo is a Aboriginal instrument that's made out of a hardwood tree. The center gets hollowed out by termites as the tree gets older. They cut it down and they basically just shave off the bark and put a wax mouthpiece on it. And that's the noise that a hollow log can make. It is a full-blown and, from what I've recently learned, a very well-respected musical instrument. It takes quite a bit of time to get good on it, but
yeah, there's a lot of technique to it.
Yeah.
Now, exactly what key is that instrument?
I think it's a C sharp.
Mine's a D sharp, I think.
But you may have heard these wherever, on YouTube or on the internet somewhere. But when you're in front of somebody playing at 10 feet from you, and they're an expert, my God, we all fell in love with it. It was such an incredible instrument, especially when they add a little accompaniment with regular music. It was incredible. Remember those guys we saw?
Yeah, they were great.
Yeah, it was definitely cool. That guy, we saw some guy in Sydney Harbor, but right away, Bob and I definitely. We're like, whoa, this is so cool, and they had a techno beat in the background, and the guy was playing from what I've discovered, it was pretty traditional technique and style that he was using, but over a techno beat, it sounded so different, so unique, and really cool. It was excellent. That's probably the reason why Steve and I ended up buying them, right, Steve?
Yeah, I mean, it was a good keepsake of our Australia visit.
It's a neat conversation piece, too.
Yeah.
Hey, look at that over there. What's that?
How many people can make a sound out of the didgeridoo in Connecticut?
A good sound.
Yeah, right.
That's the point.
The answer is zero.
So, Evan, tell us about what's special about today in science and skepticism.
Today you're listening, it's December 18th, and on this date in 1912, the discovery of the skull, known as Piltdown Man, which was the first important fossil human skull ever to be unearthed in England, it was announced on this day at a meeting of the Geological Society of Great Britain.
It was quote-unquote discovered.
Quote-unquote, yes, but announced on this day. It was actually a few years prior is when the actual discovery was made. It wasn't announced officially until Charles Dawson and another fellow by Arthur Woodward, who was the keeper of geology at the British Museum, made the official announcement. And as far as I could tell, Woodward and Dawson went to their graves believing essentially that this was a legitimate find, even though there was immediate controversy that came out and questioning of the discovery by scientists.
We don't know what they believed. I mean, we just know they stood by the claim until they died. So, I mean, one of the mysteries of the Piltdown Man, which eventually was uncovered as a hoax, was did Dawson consciously commit this fraud, or was he duped by somebody else who was committing the fraud? The consensus is that Dawson had to know what was going on.
Yeah, apparently so. He had a reputation of apparently being involved in some other dubious claims and forgeries and other things. So he definitely had a spotted past. But whatever it was, he was able to convince Woodward, certainly, to take it all the way and not give in to the pressures. It took 40 years, more than 40 years, before the scientific community finally, officially deemed Piltdown Man a hoax and a forgery.
That's true, but it didn't take them that long to realize that there was something wrong with Piltdown. So here's the quick story. I know we've touched on this before, but I think the story is important, especially since creationists still bring up Piltdown Man as evidence that evolutionists don't know what they're talking about. When the first Piltdown skull was found, it was actually found over a couple of years. There were different fossils found in England in a quarry, basically. And there was a ton of skepticism around these fossils. And a lot of scientists, especially those in the U.S., thought that the specimens represented a human skull and a primate jaw, which is actually what it was. There really wasn't widespread acceptance until the second Piltdown was discovered, Piltdown 2. You guys are aware of that, that there was actually a second Piltdown skull found? And that was what really confirmed it in a lot of people's minds because, you know, one finding could be a fluke. Just, you know, an ape jaw, human skull happened to land in the same sediment. Two had to be a creature. It had to be a species.
Wouldn't that have also pointed to it being a hoax?
Yeah, but they weren't being that cynical at that time. They weren't thinking it was a hoax. Remember, there weren't a lot of fossils, hominids, at this time. There was, you know, some specimens of Neanderthal man, and there was Java man, you know, which was a type of Homo erectus. And that was really it. And Cro-Magnon man, which is human, which is, you know, fully human.
Well, Steve, plus the skull fit the paradigm at the time, what they were thinking.
Yeah.
It made sense. Like, oh, yeah, that's what you would expect.
Yeah, large cranium, primitive jaw, which is what they thought, that the quote-unquote missing link between humans and apes would be ape-like body, human-like brain, and then there was the human brain and intellect that sort of guided the evolution of the body to the form that of modern man. And also, it was in England, and you know, the racial bias at the time was that man must have evolved in Western Europe because that's where the quote-unquote most advanced, you know, race of humans lived. It turns out the truth was the exact opposite of all of those things, where human evolution mainly took place in Africa, and the transitional species between our ape common ancestors and humans had a very human-like body, but with a much more ape-like brain. I mean, you get to like Homo erectus, where you still have a fairly small cranial capacity, but it's almost a completely modern human body. So the exact opposite of what the biases of the time were. So Piltdown man fit the biases, but not reality, which is the thing about scientific hoaxes or fraud, is that unless you happen to guess exactly right, whatever data you fake is unlikely to fit the real world data that eventually will come to light. So the second finding did quell a lot of the skepticism, but pretty much right on the heels of Piltdown man, there were more and more hominid skulls found or remains. Probably the most important was Raymond Dart's discovery of the first Australopithecus specimen. And Australopithecus was looking more human, but with still a very bigger than chimpanzee, you know, by comparison, but still the brain size is much closer to apes than the body type. The scientific community progressively marginalized the Piltdown fossils. It was being just left out of evolution books. And in fact, there was one museum, the American, I think, Museum of Natural History, that quietly classified it as a mix of ape and human fossils without outright calling it a fraud or anything. Just said, so the thinking was, nobody was thinking fraud or hoax. They were thinking, all right, it was just a mistake. It was a misidentification. It's a human skull with an ape-like jaw that happened to be together, you know, in some bizarre finding. Geologists were calling the whole finding into question. You know, really, it was increasingly out of touch with the scientific evidence. And then a new dating method came into play with dating fossils, the fluorine absorption test, and that showed that the skull was fairly recent. It, in fact, was a medieval, you know, human skull. It was hundreds of years old.
Still, though, Steve, isn't it true, though, that the technology was in place for a long time to determine that it was a fake well before the new dating techniques? If they really looked at it, you know, the way it was stained and the way it was filed down.
The source I have says that, the fluorine dating test was first proposed in 43, and it was used on the Piltdown fossils in 49. So there was a six-year delay there. But yeah, if they had filed down the fossils, they would have seen that it was stained superficially, like with an iron-type stain, and then there was fresher bone underneath. But, you know, you don't want to destroy your fossil specimens. And there wasn't a sufficient suspicion that it was a hoax to warrant that.
Yeah.
Yeah, so the new dating method is really what did it. So a very interesting story. I mean, again, it actually confirms the self-corrective process of science. And, you know, eventually these fossils were – actually, some of the findings were actual fossils. Most were modern bones that were made to look like them, were again, progressively out of step with the data, and the scientific community was skeptical from the beginning and, you know, progressively marginalized it and eventually, you know, exposed it for what it was. It actually is a, you know, a confirmation of the scientific method. So it's pretty sleazy and disingenuous that creationists ignore all the actual history and try to, you know, recast that story as, well, scientists don't know what they're talking about. Look how easily fooled they are.
Creationists suck.
Put bluntly. So, Jay, you're going to tell us about a recently discovered bacteria that likes to produce hydrogen.
Yeah, this is a really, really interesting news item that came up recently. Himadri Pakrasi of Washington University in St. Louis, Missouri, and several of his colleagues reported recently in Nature Communications that they've discovered that an ocean microbe known as Cyanobacterium cyanothes 51142. Does that mean that there's that many of them, Steve?
I don't know what the code is. I don't know if that's just sequential or if...
Now they chose it for the ease of pronunciation. Rolls right off
the
top.
Like Chanel number 5. So this particular bacteria can make hydrogen. It actually, through its metabolic processes...
Bacterium,
you're right. Sorry, Bob. Can make hydrogen. The thing that makes this discovery special is that the bacteria can do this with oxygen present. Anything before this discovery, all the bacteria that could produce hydrogen were doing it in an oxygen-free environment. There's a few things that make that very special. It's a significant change, even though it might be a minor change to the bacterium in their natural environment. But when we want to mass produce these, if we wanted to mass produce that bacterium, it's a lot less expensive and it's a lot easier to mass produce if we ever wanted to use these bacterium for hydrogen production. So, a little more backstory on this. In 1993, a man named Lewis Sherman discovered this bacterium off the coast of Texas in the United States. Later investigation done by Pakrasi revealed that the bacterium had a daytime and nighttime metabolic cycle. So during the day, it uses photosynthesis to make oxygen and branching chains of glucose, which creates molecules called glycogen. At night, a nitrogenase enzyme used the glycogen that was produced during the day to fix nitrogen found in the air into ammonia, and hydrogen happens to be a byproduct of that metabolic process. By prolonging the daytime and nighttime cycles, they were able to conclude that in a normal atmosphere, if the bacteria behaved in the same way in a liter of culture medium as they did in 25 milliliters of medium used in the experiment, they then should be able to produce about 900 milliliters of hydrogen in about 48 hours, which at this stage might not seem that significant, but that is the way that the bacteria is with absolutely zero selective breeding or any kind of manipulation whatsoever. That's just the way that they are right now.
And we can harness this hydrogen?
Well, the base idea here would be that we could possibly manipulate the bacterium or make changes to it to produce more hydrogen, to make it produce hydrogen for longer periods of time in greater amounts. And then we could have farms, literally, or tanks that we feed the bacterium and then they just pump out oxygen and hydrogen.
Right. And the ultimate source of that energy would be solar, since it's, you know, basically using photosynthesis, right, to make its energy, then eating that energy. It's, you know, the end to fix nitrogen and producing the hydrogen. So obviously this is interesting because of the coming hydrogen economy, right? You know, that what we've been promised for a decade now. The problem is hydrogen may be an excellent source of energy. We're still working on convenient ways of storing it, transmitting it, putting it into a sufficient density in cars so that it could be burned as fuel. But there's no it's not a source of energy because there's no hydrogen on the earth. There's no free hydrogen. And of course, you have to put more energy into it than you can get out of it because of thermodynamics. So it's really an energy storage medium. But if we can come up with an efficient way to mass produce hydrogen, then that could, you know, fuel the hydrogen economy. So this is potentially, you know, one source if they can scale it up. Now that's the key. So there are, you know, the article also talks about this guy Oliver Lenz at Humboldt University. So he has produced artificial systems that can produce a lot more hydrogen, you know, with out of the same amount of material. But these systems are short lived. They only last for a couple of hours. So the question is, will it be easier to take one of these artificial systems that are short lived but are highly productive and scale it up for mass production, or take one of these bacterium, you know, basically tweak it and come up with a way of feeding it and whatever, coaxing it so that it could maximize its output. It's a lot less output per unit, but it can keep going for a long period of time. What's going to be easier to scale up to massively produce hydrogen? That's the question. Or will either of them, you know, be adequate to produce enough hydrogen to make it economically viable?
Well, Steve, I think if I remember correctly, they did actually make some genetic enhancements as a test to see if that would increase the hydrogen output, and they did do it. They already did
it.
Another point about this, about the hydrogen fuel cells, and you know, what would we be doing with hydrogen if we could mass produce it? I did read quite a bit about people saying that we would burn it as a fuel to produce electricity, and electricity is a much easier and better system moving forward than using a hydrogen fuel cell. I'm sure that there's a lot of debate about that, and believe me, am I making a formal statement here about which way I think is better or worse, but you know, I thought that was very interesting, just saying that this is a raw source of fuel and not something that should be moved directly into let's not make hydrogen-powered cars today. Like, maybe the slide would be that we would start using the hydrogen produced to burn and make electricity out of. So, you know, slowly snowball the whole electric world as opposed to the hydrogen world.
Yeah, I don't think anyone could really guess at this point which way the infrastructure is going to go, because it's just, you know, we're actually, neither of them are ready for prime time yet. I think we've hit more roadblocks with hydrogen, and the electric vehicles seem to be more poised. But I still don't know if anyone can say where we're going to be in 20 years.
No, but yeah, definitely not. But I wonder how dense of an energy source would hydrogen be? I mean, I guess that depends on how you pack it. But I suspect it still wouldn't be nearly as dense as you know, oil, gasoline.
Of course not. But you know, Bob, it isn't. You know, when we're in a car driving to work and we have, you know, 16 gallons of gasoline in our tank, you know, a number of things are going on. One, first and foremost, it's a pollutant and it's a horrible waste of a wonderful resource. Number two, right. You know, gasoline is ridiculously energy rich. There's a lot of energy packed into oil-based fuels. But we don't need that level. We don't need that. Most of us just drive to work every day. You know, we don't need the power of gasoline in all of our cars.
The power.
It's true, though. I mean, if you think about it, you know, once we break, like, what was it, Steve? You've said this several times. There's like a 300-mile barrier.
Yeah, 200, 300 miles, you know.
The
but
range,
it's also the...
For the
tank
for
of gas.
Range,
yeah.
It's also how quickly can you refuel, though. If you have to recharge your battery overnight...
Yeah.
You have to.
It's a problem.
Yeah, it's a problem. You have to construct your driving habits around that, and it limits the utility of that vehicle. You know, it means no road trips, right? Because you know, the best thing about a tank of gas is that it takes 5 minutes to refill your tank. That's the best thing.
Yeah.
What about little nuclear stations, right? Couldn't they generate such a charge that could recharge a battery so quickly, 5-10 minutes or something?
It's not, well, whatever the source of the energy is, they are working on. So, you know, if you're recharging your battery, your car battery, from your outlet in your house, it's going to take 12 hours.
Yeah.
But if you have a recharging station that has a much higher, you know, voltage and current, then you can recharge it quicker. Maybe you can get it down to a couple of hours. But still, a couple of hours is nice. It means you can recharge your car when you're at work, or, again, it's easy to do it overnight. But it's still not on the fly. It's still not while you're driving down the road. You pull into a station, you recharge your battery, and you go.
Doesn't it seem kind of obvious that we should just have, like, removable batteries from cars, like a big battery block that
that's the other option, is that you have stations which swap out your battery, then the batteries are constantly being recharged at the station, but you pull up, they give you a fresh one, and you're on your way.
They had that in Fifth Element. Remember those ships? They pulled those big canisters out, and you shove another canister in, and you're on your way.
Yeah. That may be that system. And there's actually an Israeli company that is working on that system.
Oh, awesome. That's cool.
Yeah, it's a battery swap-out. But all these things need infrastructure, you know, so it's hard to make a quick switch.
Another proposal, just replace the fluid. Was it the electrolyte fluid? Is that it?
Yeah.
That was another option. But it was funny because they were saying that we could recharge your battery in 2 minutes. Like, well, you're not really recharging it if you're just doing that. But it's a good idea, I think.
But, Bob, think of it this way. Yeah, the recharge process, it would be like refining oil to make gasoline. It's not happening at the gas station. But if they have the ability to store or recharge that liquid at the gas station and they swap out your old fluid for your new fluid, that's like filling your car up.
Yeah.
Right.
For the end user, it has to be you pull in, something happens in 5 minutes, and you leave with a full tank, right? That's what has to happen.
Yeah. And it can't cost more than $40-$50.
So like right, something for, happens, you know.
Well, whatever. There's
multiple ways to get
there. Nanomachines
are swarming around your car, and then all of a sudden.
All right. Let's move on. Bob, tell us about Voyager's exit from the solar system.
Well, guys, the V'ger probe. Sorry, I meant the Voyager 1 probe. Somebody had to say it.
I shed a tear when you said that, Bob. Just letting you know.
The Voyager 1 probe is about to reach a pretty cool milestone in the annals of spaceflight and discovery. It will kind of soon officially exit the solar system. And before we get emails, Star Trek emails, I realize that Star Trek the Motion Picture, it wasn't Voyager 1, it was Voyager 6, which never existed. So I still wanted to say that. Anybody remember September 5th, 1977?
Of course I do.
That was,
yes.
You know, I was drunk at the time.
I've got this memory of a rocket shooting off. I think it's probably a false memory, but it's kind of in there anyway. That was pretty much a historic event in spaceflight. This was the launch of Voyager 1, and Voyager 2, of course, was launched at another time right around that. So the launch of the Voyager 1 and 2 probes essentially gave us unprecedented looks at the largest planets in the solar system, Jupiter, Saturn, Neptune, and Uranus. And Steve, do you remember eagerly just waiting for these flybys and just seeing for really the best look we've ever had at these Jovians? It was an amazing time. Voyager also, it didn't just give us this great look at Jupiter and Saturn and everything, but it also helped us appreciate the diversity and the interesting moons that are out there. We really, before then, you know, the moons are moons. You know, our moon is great, but it's really a little boring after a while just kind of looking at it. Of course, that's kind of a stupid thing to say.
No, you're right, though. I mean, we get accustomed to it, but now all of a sudden there's all these other moons that I remember, like, first seeing them and being like, oh, my God, look at how small they look. And it was a really cool thing to witness for the first time.
Yeah, it really made you appreciate them even more than we already had. Europa, Io, Titan, Ganymede. I mean, it really made moons seem more interesting than the planets themselves. Is what Niels was saying, and I think he's absolutely right. The diversity out there. I mean, God, for God's sake, Europa might have life on it. Jeez, I mean,
which God?
So that, all right, as awesome as that was, that's like the first part of Voyager's career, right? So you know, you might think, well, what you know. What could it do for an encore so many years later, right?
What have you done for me lately?
Yeah. You may have even thought that Voyager was just a dead hulk in space, just chugging along, but it's really still sending us information 33 years and about 11 billion miles later. It's still actually doing some good work, which kind of brings us to the news item there, the Voyager actually exiting the solar system. Now,
Bob, what's powering it? It's got to be solar energy, right?
No, nuclear.
No, it's just it's radioactive decay that's letting it send us information, and that's I think one website said that we can get another 10 or 20 years out of it. I don't know how accurate that was, but yeah, I mean it's an incredible fuel source.
And the other thing is, explain what you mean by exiting the solar system. Like, how far out past Pluto do you got to go?
Yeah, that's a good point, because you know, you might think that, all right, after, you know, after the last planet, you're at the end of, you know, you're at the far edge of the solar system, like maybe after Neptune or maybe after the Kuiper Belt objects, like that what's it called? Pluto. After Pluto.
And now it's a dwarf planet.
Right.
Let's call it for what it
well,
is.
It's a Kuiper Belt object. So you might think, well, maybe that's it. But it's really – it's a bit subjective. But astronomers, I think, have a really good definition. It makes a lot of sense. You know, the end of the influence of the sun in space is pretty much a really good definition, except, of course, for the photons. But we're really just talking about the solar wind. The solar wind, I think, is a big thing. So you – you want to look at the entire solar system from that in that regard, the key word here is heliosphere, and that's pretty much the bubble that our solar system is in, and it's defined by the solar wind. So the solar wind, we've talked about it many times.
So gravity doesn't play into this?
No, we get this far out, Jay. 10 billion miles, gravity is pretty inconsequential. But in terms of shaping the outer limits of the solar system, it's all about solar wind. So you've got the solar wind emanating these charged particles coming out of the sun, and they're kind of just pushing against the interstellar medium that's out there, pushing and pushing. So you've got this bubble. Outside of that, you've got the interstellar medium of the hydrogen and helium gas that's kind of permeating the galaxies. So that's the heliosphere. So then at the very edge of this heliosphere, you've got something called the heliosheath.
And this is after the heliosphere, right?
No, it's not after. It's kind of the edge. It's the outer envelope. The outermost part of this heliosphere is the heliosheath. And this could be as far away as about 100 AU, which is 100 astronomical units. Each unit is 93 million miles, which is the distance from the Earth to the sun. So now that distance, of course, can vary because the shape of this heliosphere is not—it's not a ball. It's not—it's kind of got this odd shape, and it could vary from—I've read from 10 to 100 AU. So there's a lot of variability there.
Wow.
So the thing about the heliosheath, though, is that the solar wind has already is slowed down. It's kind of turbulently mixing with this, interstellar space that's beyond it. And this is the real milestone now with Voyager. Voyager is now at the very edge of this heliosheath.
Yeah, so it no longer has the solar wind at its back, basically.
Right, and so what the solar wind is now doing at this point, this is the outer edge of even the heliosheath. Earlier on, the heliosheath is kind of a little bit more active, but at the part where the Voyager is, the solar wind has actually stopped kind of blowing relative to the Voyager, and it's actually kind of going sideways. There's no really there's no outward radial motion. It's really just kind of going sideways, and Voyager is going through it. So that's the heliosheath, and that's kind of what Voyager is exiting kind of right now. And in a few years, I think around 2014, it's going to enter the heliopause. Now this is the last exit in our solar system. That the solar wind is so weak that it can't push back the winds, the solar winds from the other stars. So once
Bob, is that where the toll booth is?
Last exit.
We're just looking for it. It hasn't found it yet.
So I wonder out there, what if you did turn around, as I'm sure Carl Sagan, if he were alive, he'd want to know, what does it look like looking back in? Can you even see the sun at that point?
Yeah.
It'd just be another star.
Yeah, it'd be a bright star. One website described it as one of the brightest stars in the sky. But yeah, it's just a bright star. That's it.
One more news item. This also is another cool science news item. You guys have heard about the snowball Earth hypothesis?
Yes, absolutely.
Early on in Earth's existence, it was entirely frozen over at one very cold point.
Actually, three very cold points.
Slushy.
That's what I meant. Three very cold points.
Yeah, there were three times in which the Earth's temperature plummeted to the point where the entire Earth was covered with glaciers and snow, basically.
That's called global cooling.
Yes.
Even the equator, I guess, and the big mystery, though, isn't the question of, how do you come back from that? Once you're frozen solid, how do you possibly come back? And I believe the answer is volcanoes.
Yeah, volcanoes.
A space ice pick.
Well, let's talk about – so there are three times during which there was the snowball Earth phenomenon.
How many times?
2.2 billion years ago, about 710 million years ago, and the most recent one, 635 million years ago. This is actually interesting because – there were geologists who were seeing evidence that maybe this had happened, but they didn't know how it could happen. And at the same time, there were physicists who were modeling the Earth and realized that this could happen, but they didn't think it actually did happen. And then they got together, basically. So the way this could happen is as the Earth cools, the polar caps expand, and that increases the average albedo of the Earth, right, because the snow is white, it reflects more of the sunlight away, and that causes a positive feedback loop where the colder it gets, the more sunlight gets reflected away and the colder it gets. And this just has a runaway cooling effect until the entire world is a giant snowball. But now it's thought that what multiple things could have triggered this and got the snowball rolling, as it were. But it seems, and I think that there's no consensus on definitely what triggered all three of these events, but they do seem to correlate with a rise in the atmosphere of oxygen. Around 2.5 billion years ago, bacteria were starting to crank out O2, filling the atmosphere with O2. When it got to about 1%, what happened was that the oxygen reacted with the methane in the atmosphere. Now, methane, molecule for molecule, is a much more powerful greenhouse gas than carbon dioxide, even though there's a lot more CO2 than methane.
It smells, too.
The methane has a big effect. So the oxygen in the atmosphere was reacting with the methane, getting rid of it from the atmosphere, dropped in a greenhouse effect, and then that started this feedback loop leading to the snowball Earth. That lasted tens of millions of years, and then the Earth came out of it for another billion years, and then it had two episodes in rapid succession, right, just in the Precambrian period, right before the evolution of multicellular life. And at this time, during this period, the oxygen in the atmosphere also was rapidly increasing up to, the present day, approximately 21% O2 in the atmosphere. So probably not a coincidence. As Bob said, once the Earth does become entirely frozen over, how do you get out of it? And the thinking is that, volcanoes broke through, spewed forth enough CO2 to reverse the process. Of course, once you start reversing the process, that also creates a feedback loop that will continue to push it in the other direction.
So have we ever had a fireball Earth?
Whoa.
Yes. It was first accreting, I'm sure it was a fireball. Yeah.
That was called the Hadean period.
The hell-like
period.
The early bombardment period.
Yeah, and then followed by the late heavy bombardment period. So that's all around 4 billion years ago. Yeah, it was basically just a giant molten lava.
I just had that happen in my bathroom.
It's all right.
Hey, wait, I just had a cool image in my head of a snowball Earth dotted with with these volcanoes just belching fire.
Yeah,
that would be a cool picture.
So one of the questions is, how did life survive these periods? It's estimated that the surface ice was so thick that photosynthesis really could not have occurred, in the oceans beneath it. If the entire surface were frozen over, what could have survived? There are, extremophiles that can survive at the ocean vents, on the bottom of the ocean floor. So there are certain kinds of bacteria that could have survived.
Well, chemosynthetic life, basically.
Yeah,
no need for photosynthesis at all.
We've discovered bacteria in the Arctic and Antarctic that can survive freezing temperatures, so that they might have been able to survive as well. But it is a question, how could enough life have survived, not just these few specialty type of bacteria, so that life made it through these periods intact enough to subsequently evolve into all the life we have on the Earth.
It's like a cryogenic experiment almost.
Right. Actually, what this period of time is called? The most recent two Snowball Earth episodes?
The Frozone layer.
Frozone.
They are the first one, the 700 million year ago one, is the McHannony snowball. That's the McHannony era. And the second one is the Sturdian. Collectively, they are called the cryogenian epoch.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, cryogenian. That's a cool word.
So from what you were saying, when one of these events takes place, it basically resets the life on the planet back to bacteria.
Well, that's the question. It doesn't appear to have done that. So that's the question. How come it didn't do that? So now there is a new finding. A team looking at sediment layers in Australia have dated sediments to the Sturdian glaciation. This is the one that's 700 million years ago of the cryogenian period, that shows formations that are consistent with a roiling sea, which shouldn't occur during the snowball Earth phase.
So what's a roiling sea?
A
wavy ocean.
Water, liquid at the surface, basically.
Okay.
This contradicts the snowball Earth hypothesis, at least.
Sure.
At least what it means is that there were regionally, at least in parts of the Earth, that it wasn't completely frozen over. So
pockets of
So there were pockets, basically pockets of water, and so there are some that are saying that maybe we need to revise it to the slush ball hypothesis, That was, yeah, more slushy rather than, at least in places, rather than frozen all the way around the Earth. And this, of course, would solve the problem of, you know, how did life survive? If there was, you know, any significant, you know, pools of liquid water, that's where life survived, you know, during this period.
I don't think the creationists are very happy with that explanation, frankly.
Probably not. So it's another revision based upon new evidence. And I think the whole snowball Earth thing I find fascinating. You know, just imagine the entire Earth plunged in glaciers and snow.
It's almost impossible to really put your head there, you know. It's like, yeah. How could that possibly be? But
for millions of years, not much was happening, you know.
Boring.
It was all frozen. Yeah, probably, not much to do back then.
Yep. A lot of school days closed.
It's like my sex life in college, you know.
Ba-dum-bum.
Well, let's go on to Who's That Noisy?
It's been a little while since we've done one of these.
Yeah, we took a break for the live shows, but we're getting back on track now. So
we're getting back to it. So maybe, for those of you with good memories, we'll remember this little ditty that I played a few weeks back.
And why am I here, you ask? See these little mini volcanoes? They contain a certain primordial ooze that I need for my latest evil device. Behold, the De-Evolutionator!
The De-Evolutionator?
The De-Evolutionator. Oh, what a great episode that was. And of course, I'm referring to the uncompromising voice of Dr. Heinz Doofenshmirtz from the series Phineas and Ferb, which is a cartoon that is shown on the Disney Channel. It's an excellent show. I mean, for all of those out there who enjoy, you know, Futurama, we've got a lot of Simpson listeners in the audience, Family Guy and all the... If you haven't, check out Phineas and Ferb. It's great. These guys... have so much fun with science, pseudoscience, and, you know, every variation of the genre, and they turn it into these hilarious musical numbers, and the characters are always experimenting with things. It's great. I love that show to death.
Is it intended for kids?
It is. It's the target audience is like, you know, 8 to 10 year olds, but believe me, anybody of any age, and especially our generation, would find it hilarious. Congratulations to Rufel Rabbit, who guessed first correctly. Well done,
Waspily Rabbit.
Behind
all
the
right.
Rabbit.
Evan, what do you got for this week?
Here we go. This week's Who's That Noisy? Did you get that?
Okay.
That's an 85-year-old guy sucking his teeth.
All right. Well, give it your best guess. Good luck, everyone.
All right. Thanks, Evan. I think we got time for one email this week before we go on to our interview. This one comes from Brendan from Melbourne, Australia, and he writes, I was wondering why almost all you come across regarding extraterrestrial life, it seems to almost exclusively be focused on alien animal life. Why not alien plants? What would it mean if we found a moon or planet with alien plant life but no animals? Is that even possible or vice versa? Is it just that the idea of little gray men are sexier than Martian ferns? Obviously, there are some basic fundamentals I fail to understand on the distinction between the plants and animals, so how much of one is there? In a way, it almost appears as if the two are alien life forms with a symbiotic and side-by-side relationship. What is a distinction that separated life into the plant and animal kingdoms? Is there a common ancestor to both? If they did find a fern on Mars, somehow it just doesn't seem as exciting as, say, a Martian worm. P.S. My example was originally a Martian flower, but for obvious reasons, that was a bad example. Brendan. I think he means because he's assuming that all flowers need bees to pollinate them or something. Therefore, they need animals. But that's not true. I mean, there are flowers that don't need insects. But anyway...
Well, first we have to define the difference between plant life and animal life.
All right.
And first we should avoid the false dichotomy of plant versus animal. Because mm-hmm. those are only...
No, it's zombie. It's plants versus zombies.
Plants versus zombies.
That's right.
Plants and animals are two kingdoms of life on Earth. Do you know how many kingdoms there are?
Five.
Well, there's a kingdom of heaven.
There are six.
Oh, yes. Are there six?
There are six.
Number five.
Plants.
Animals.
Animals.
Bacteria, archaea.
Bacteria, archaea. Archaebacteria, eubacteria. Fungi. And protists.
And lawyers.
And creationists.
Right.
There's eight.
So those are the six kingdoms of life, so I don't know why you would discriminate against the other four and just talk about animals and plants. In fact, probably, if you know, once we're flitting around the galaxy exploring for life, we're probably going to find, you know, most
bacteria.
Planets are going to be mostly filled with things that are like bacteria,
yeah,
or fungi, right, or things like that.
I'm a fungi.
Stuff we can't even identify.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think alien life would be in any of those six kingdoms. They would be their own kingdoms.
Or that, they would take distinct elements from multiple kingdoms in one.
A hybrid?
For example.
Yeah, like a planimal.
Yeah, yeah, planimal.
Or a mushman.
Yeah, right. Why couldn't there be things that kind of grow like a fungus, but they can walk around and also
and they have two heads.
Use photosynthesis?
That's, yeah, like City of Heroes does that.
That would be the coolest thing. You know, things that are so different that they won't even be approximations of any of the six kingdoms of life that we recognize on Earth. They would be something else entirely.
That'd be awesome.
Yeah. But there are probably things that get their energy from the mostly from the sun, and we would call them plant-like. There's probably going to be other things that eat stuff, you know, and we'll call them animals. Right? I mean, but they still will be different. They'll be fundamentally different than what we recognize as life on Earth.
Steve, is it a coincidence that plants have cells and animals have cells? Like,
no.
Are we calling them, you know, it's not a coincidence. So
he asked, do they have a common ancestor? And the answer is yes. We are in fact very closely related to peas. We have the same exact histones, which are proteins that sort of wind up the DNA to keep it under control inside the nucleus of the cell. So yeah, we are closely related to plants.
But that common answer, Steve, wouldn't it be probably as like a single cell eukaryote?
Yeah, it'd be a eukaryote going back into the Precambrian era, right?
What's a eukaryote?
It's a cell with a nucleus.
The DNA is isolated in a nucleus in the cell. But it was so – what I think what happened is you know, we were – when we had our common ancestor, some of these eukaryotes probably incorporated, I would think, like these chloroplasts into the DNA, just like animals incorporated mitochondrial, like bacteria, into the DNA, making it part of the organism permanently. So I think so. That would be an interesting divergence point where, you know, when it went the photosynthetic route as opposed to the mitochondrial route. You know,
NASA has talked about they predicted. This is back in 2007. I found an article on their website about what plants might look like on other planets, at least what color they might be. And although they speculate a lot of different ones, they said most likely it would be non-green and probably black or very, very dark.
Like to absorb more sunlight?
Yeah.
Well, yeah, I mean, the plants on Earth are green to absorb the majority of the light from the sun.
Which is yellow light.
Yeah, we have a yellow sun, but if you look at the wavelengths that are put out, there's no such thing as a green sun. Did you know that? Just the way the spectra would combine, they'd never produce a green sun.
That's not to say there's not green light, right, Steve?
Well, yeah, it's mixed in there, but it would never look green. You have red suns, you know, orange, yellow, and then
yeah, that's true.
Goes right to blue, and then there's no green anyway.
It's green.
But if you look at the spectra of light that's put out by the sun, green is well positioned to sort of capture the most of that. So that's why plants tend to be green. But on a different planet with a different sun, with a different spectrum, the plants would be different. They would have some other color that to maximally absorb the light of their sun.
We're talking predominantly about visible light. What about light that exists above and below the visible spectrum?
Well, yeah, including outside of the human visible spectrum, absolutely.
Infrared, ultraviolet, yeah, we're just a tiny slice.
So there could be plants on other planets that are colors that we can't even see.
Jay, there are plants on this planet that are colors we can't see.
Don't get crazy, all right? I've taken a walk around a few times.
There are plants, Jay, that bugs can see in UV. They make these really nice patterns that we're oblivious to. But for a bug, it's like, oh, there's a landing strip.
Yeah, so you're saying there's invisible plants out there? Give it up.
Oh, they're invisible.
Someday, I hope, with future nanotechnology, one of the upgrades that I get is that I can derive my energy directly from the sun, like Superman.
That would be a fun upgrade to be able to do photosynthesis and just...
You'd probably have to sit in the sun all day just to move 10 feet, but it's okay.
The question is, would the sun give you gas? Like solar wind.
Guesses. No?
Yeah, but it would be oxygen instead of CO2.
Oh, okay.
Would you need to sleep? I mean, geez, forget about it.
That's another thing. I definitely would want to, if not not completely remove, I'd greatly reduce the amount of time I'd need to
sleep. I bet you we could do a whole episode of The Skeptic's Guide and just talk about sleep subjects, sleep-related subjects.
Oh, yeah.
Absolutely.
Or the biology and physics of superheroes, which is kind of what this touches on, too, because definitely superheroes have some kind of extra energy production in their cells. That's got to be the core feature of any superhero power, right?
Exactly, yeah. I mean, with what they're pulling off.
Or at least that would be a prerequisite, I would think. Maybe they have some organelle that's like super mitochondria. Let's call them midichlorians, just for shits and giggles.
Oh, gosh. Do we have to?
Let's not.
Mises say no goodsy ideas.
Okay, I still to this day, when I hear that stupid accent, I want to throw up on my shoes.
Oh,
get
no.
Out of here. God, what an idiot.
That was the biggest disappointment in movie history.
Oh, God. You know, they had me going for like the first 15, 20 minutes when, you know, they're in there and they're breathing in the air so they don't get poisoned and the stupid bartering aliens. And they go down on the planet and they meet Jar Jar Binks and I'm like, the movie is over.
Series is dead.
It's dead. That's it. Couldn't get out of 15 minutes.
It was very disappointing, Jar Jar Binks. Let's end there. We'll end on Jar Jar and go on with our interview. We are talking now with Dan Gardner. Dan, welcome to The Skeptic's Guide.
Thanks for having me.
And Dan is a journalist and author of the recent book Future Babble, which is all about how horrible experts are at predicting the future. Dan, you know, looking through this book and listening to your interviews and everything, I was struck by the fact that you make a lot of the same points and refer to a lot of the same research that we in the skeptical community do. Essentially, you're applying the same kind of points that we make to this specific question of expert predictions. Did you know that you were a skeptic?
I have figured that out. It's sort of like discovering your sexuality. Yes, I have come out as a skeptic. I generally try to avoid labels, as skeptics tend to do, for the very good reason that the labels tend to guide your thinking, which is not healthy. There's no question that foundational to my thinking is the idea that evidence matters and that I have to think about my own thinking and all these other very basic steps which are foundational to skepticism.
So how did you get interested in this question about expert predictions?
Well, it might be an outgrowth of my last book, The Science of Fear, which was also called Risk outside the United States, which was about risk, why we worry about the things that we don't shouldn't worry about and we don't worry about the things that we should worry about. And then, of course, at the end of that book, in which I said basically we are the happiest, healthiest human beings who ever lived, you run up against the argument, well, okay, we're the happiest, healthiest human beings who ever lived now, but what about in the future? Couldn't civilization collapse in any number of ways, and shouldn't we all be terrified therefore? And that, of course, gets you into the realm of future predictions. And so my next book, Future Babble, picked up from there. And the interesting thing is, I have an historical, some training in history, and I have an historical bent. And the interesting thing is, if you have a good sense of memory, you should already have a good sense that, in fact, expert predictions about the future, whether dismal or utopian, are really, really bad at predicting the future. And so I always had that sense, and I could rhyme off many, many examples of very famous predictions which failed spectacularly. But as all good skeptics know, rhyming off examples, telling anecdotes doesn't prove anything. In order to prove that, in fact, experts are bad at predicting the future, you have to conduct a pretty rigorous and, frankly, painstaking and exhausting experiment. You have to get together a whole huge group of experts. You have to get them to do a huge amount of prediction. You have to ask them questions where the outcome is clear. And then you gather up all your data once enough time has passed that you can determine whether a prediction was accurate or not. And then you have to crunch the numbers. And, you know, it's a really huge undertaking. It sounds like a small thing. You know, how do we determine whether experts are good or not at predicting the future? It sounds like a simple thing, but it's actually not when you really dig into it. And of course, it is entirely beyond my capacity to do that experiment. But fortunately, someone else has done it. And that's Philip Tetlock, who's a University of California psychologist. Starting in the late 1980s, he began this monumental experiment. I mean, it was an enormously difficult experiment. He basically gathered together a group of almost 280 experts, economists, political scientists, intelligence analysts, journalists, people whose job, at least in part, is forecasting the future. And he started asking them questions about the future of the sort that they answer all the time anyway. What's the inflation rate going to be like? What's going to happen with economic growth? Will there be an election? Who will win the election? Will there be a war? Who will win the war? Those sorts of things. And he amasses about 28,000 predictions, which is a spectacular database. And he let time pass. And he, time passed and he figured out, did this prediction come to pass or not? Were these predictions accurate or not? And massive amounts of data crunching was done. And he broke down the data and he came to two basic conclusions. The first conclusion, which cynics like, is that the average expert is about as accurate as a dart-thrown chimpanzee. Which is to say that they're about as accurate as random guessing, which is a really dismal outcome. That's the outcome of the experiment which is most often cited by some people who in many cases are cynical, frankly. There was a more interesting outcome of the experiment, a much more interesting and revealing outcome, and it was this. Remember that I said the average expert was about as accurate as a flipped coin? Well, there was actually a distribution of results, and of course, that means that some experts were worse than average, some were better than average, which is pretty amazing. The ones who were worse than average, bear in mind, were actually worse than a flipped coin. They would have been, they would have been better off if they'd done random guessing, which is pretty amazing. There were experts who did better than average. They were better than random guessing. And what that means is they actually had meaningful predictive insight. Now, it was still modest. They were miles from perfect. The world really is, in many ways, fundamentally unpredictable. But they did have genuine predictive insight.
Well, I have a question about that before we move on. Could it be that that's just the bell curve that you're going to get, just a distribution, and that some people just got lucky? I assume if you did the same kind of analysis with 200 astrologers, some are going to do better than average by chance, some worse than average by chance, but they would all average out to a null effect.
Yeah.
So are we just seeing that? Were those guys just lucky, or can we really conclude that they had some predictive powers?
See, this is why it's annoying to talk to skeptics, because you ask hard questions. No, that's a great question. And, of course, it's the kind of question which I'm never asked when I'm interviewed by a journalist.
Right.
And my answer to that is Phil Tetlock's research was published in a book called Expert Political Judgment, an academic book, which was published in 2005. And in the back of that book, which is an amazingly painstaking piece of writing, in the back there are appendices which deal with the math in amazing and painful detail, and some of it answers your question. And the answer is yes, it was real meaningful predictive insight, which is why, in fact, Tetlock's research has been as influential as it is.
Right.
It's really rock solid stuff.
And how good did the best predictors do? I mean,
not very good at all.
It's still only a little bit better than chance.
When you go to judge the accuracy or the quality of expert predictions, one measure, obviously, that you're going to test them against is random guessing. But there are other measures as well. You can have very simple arbitrary rules, for instance, such as always predict no change. Those sorts of arbitrary rules obviously are going to be pretty bad at predicting the future, and yet the really depressing fact is that even the experts in Tetlock's experiment who did better than random chance, who had real predictive insight, they were basically beaten by those arbitrary rules. So we are talking about modest predictive insight. And this is one of the fundamental takeaways from the subject entirely, is that, you know, there are true limits to what sort of forecasting we can hope to accomplish, particularly sort of subjective forecasts made by experts.
And the other major finding was that the people who did better were less confident and the people who did worse were more confident. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, well, this is the interesting insight, right? So you have this one group of people who are worse than a flip coin, and you have this other group of people who are better than random guessing but still modest in their results. What distinguishes them? Is it whether they're left wing or right wing? No, that didn't make a difference. Is it whether they had access to classified information? Is it whether they had PhDs or not? Whether they had university affiliations or not? It was, you know, Tetlock went down this long list of possible explanations that would distinguish the two groups, and none of them fit. There was only one thing that made the difference, and this is what's so revealing about his experiment, is that it was the style of thinking that made the difference. The experts who were worse than random guessing, they tended to have one analytical tool, which they were sure was the right tool, and so they kept using it over and over again to stamp out predictions, and because they were sure their analytical tool was right, they were highly confident that their predictions were right. The other type of experts who are better than random guessing, they didn't have one analytical tool. They'd used many analytical tools. They like to gather information from diverse sources. And here's the other critical component. They were comfortable with complexity and uncertainty. So unlike the first group, they were comfortable saying, I think this is going to happen, but really it's possible that other things could intervene and the future could turn out differently. And so you end up with this paradox that those who were more confident tended to be less accurate, and those who were less confident tended to be more accurate.
Yeah.
And Tetlock broke these two groups down. He used borrowing terms from an old Isaiah Berlin essay. He labeled these two groups foxes and hedgehogs because in the old parable, the hedgehog knows one big thing, the fox knows many things. Well, that hedgehog style, I have one big idea and I will use it to peer into the future, that's a disaster. It doesn't work. The fox style is much, it produces possibly real predictive insight, although, again, modest predictive insight. Okay. And the really depressing last note to that distinction is this. If you ask yourself, well, when I open a newspaper, when I turn on the television, when I look at the bestseller lists in the New York Times, what sort of expert am I hearing from? What sort of expert is telling me about the future? Well, it's almost always a hedgehog, right? They have a nice, simple, clear story. They're certain of what's going to happen, and they're highly confident, right? They're very articulate. They're very compelling presences. Whereas the hedgehog is the sort of person who says, well, on the one hand, on the other hand, maybe, possibly. Well, you don't hear much of that on television nor in the newspapers, do you? And in fact, when Tetlock actually found an amazing inverse correlation in his data, he actually found that the more famous the expert was, the less accurate he was.
Quick question, Dan. Talking about experts specifically, I was wondering, were there any criteria for actually deciding that this person is an expert and this person isn't necessarily an expert?
Well, it's not that narrow, and for a good reason. But here's something interesting. Now, bear in mind that, as I said, the range of experts was very broad. You had everybody from journalists to intelligence analysts to economists. Well, of course, when you're asking all those people about so many different questions, inflation rates, wars, and so on, in many cases, they're not really making predictions as experts because it's not their field of expertise. Mm-hmm. Only sometimes will the questions pertain to their field of expertise. And so you can make a distinction between the times when they're making predictions as what you might call small e experts, more like an informed observer, a smart, informed observer, or those times when they are genuine capital E experts making predictions about their field of expertise. And the really strange result of Tetlock's in Tetlock's data was that foxes, when they were making predictions in their field of expertise as capital E experts, they got more accurate, as you would expect would be the case. But amazingly, hedgehogs actually got less accurate when they were making predictions as capital E experts.
Now, what's interesting is listening to you review that research is that it's very similar to the research on memory. So not predicting the future, but just memory of your of past events. People are overconfident. They're,
yes.
they're poorly calibrated. When mm-hmm. they think they're 90% sure about something, they're actually wrong 50% of the time. And confidence doesn't predict accuracy. So this seems to be more of a generic problem with human cognition and not necessarily isolated to the complexity of predicting the future.
Oh, that's absolutely correct. If you look at all the different ways in which experts can fool themselves and come up with bad predictions, they are facets of human psychology, not expert psychology. The critical distinction, I think, is this. That people tend to think that if you are an intelligent and informed person, as an expert is sort of by definition, that very fact alone will prevent you from making these sorts of mistakes. They will prevent you from being overconfident in your judgment. They will prevent you from slipping into confirmation bias. They will prevent you from slipping into all these other psychological foibles. And that's simply wrong. In fact, if an expert is unwary, if they do not practice metacognition, which is to say that they don't think about their own thinking and go looking for their own mistakes, their intelligence and their knowledge can actually supercharge those psychological foibles and cause them to make absolutely spectacular mistakes. In my book, I talk about Arnold Toynbee, the great British historian of the mid-20th century. He's now completely forgotten, but in the mid-20th century, around the 1950s, if you were at a smart cocktail party in Manhattan, everybody was talking about Arnold Toynbee. Because Arnold Toynbee wrote these mammoth books in which he claims to have spotted a pattern in every single human civilization, in how those civilizations evolve, how they rise, and how they fall. And based on that pattern, he was going to predict where modern Western civilization was at and its coming fall. That was pretty heady stuff. How did he do this? Well, if you go back and you look at how Arnold Toynbee developed his ideas and created this mammoth project, it was basically confirmation bias on steroids. Mm-hmm. He started with this illusory pattern. That's one of the standard psychological foibles. We see patterns that don't exist. And then he went looking for facts that fit the pattern. And lo and behold, in looking for facts that fit the pattern, he found lots and lots and lots and lots. Yeah. And, by the way, he ignored facts that didn't fit the pattern, or he bashed on them hard until they did fit the pattern. In fact, I would suggest that the collected works of Arnold Toynbee are, stand as a grand monument to the power of confirmation bias. So, Arnold Toynbee is a great illustration of the fact that intelligence and education and expertise are no protection against the psychological foibles which lead human beings to make terrible mistakes.
How much of this is the inherent unpredictability of the future because of chaos? How could that be true if there are even some individuals who can be consistently successful?
Right. And by the way, when I say consistently successful, they fail lots.
Yeah.
George Soros has documented his own failures extensively. so no one's omniscient. You're absolutely right. There is a tension there. And the way I like to describe it is by reference to the weather. Basically, if you look at weather forecasting 24 hours out, much as we like to make jokes about weathermen, they're actually really good. 24-hour forecasts are very, very accurate these days. 48-hour forecasts are a little less accurate. 72-hour forecasts less accurate still. You get out to about 5-6 days, And basically, you might as well give up.
Yeah.
You know, you might as well flip a coin at that point. And that is because of chaos theory. We may, with the advance of computer power, with the advance of scientific understanding of weather, push that horizon further out a little bit more, but we do know that there are fundamental limits to what we can forecast in weather, and we will never be able to go on beyond those limits. And so to take that back to the fox, remember, what is the fox, one of the essential attributes of the fox? They're humble about their ability to predict the future. In fact, Phil Tetlock very often found that some of the experts who were best at predicting the future very often said, I can't predict the future, but, you know, you're asking me to, so I guess I will. That sort of humility is essential, because what it means is that the fox is doing his best to try and recognize the limits of human forecasting, to say, you know what, there are certain things you just can't forecast. Who's going to win the presidential election in 2016? Give up now. You are foolish to try and answer that question. You know, what will the? I read a paper recently from the Carnegie Endowment, the geopolitical order in 2050.
Wow.
You have to be delusional to think that you can make that kind of a forecast, and yet we do it all the time.
So it sounds like the take-home message of all of this is to be comfortable with uncertainty, comfortable with complexity, and humble about your own ability.
Absolutely right. And on top of that, I would add this. Learn some basic psychology, because it's only by knowing about those psychological traps that we can avoid them.
Right, which is another way of saying be skeptical.
Yeah, absolutely right. But yours fits on a bumper sticker.
Right. Well, Dan, thanks so much. This is a very interesting interview. We really appreciate your time.
Yeah, I enjoyed it a lot, guys.
All right. Take care.
It's time for Science or Fiction.
Each week, I come up with three science news items or facts, two genuine and one fictitious, and then I challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me which one is the fake. You guys ready?
Yes.
Misa ready.
Here we go. Evan, that's a short trip to a smack bottom. Here we go. A new study demonstrates that it is possible to become drunk from dunking one's feet in alcohol for several hours. Item number two, the atomic weights of 10 elements, including hydrogen, carbon, nitrogen, and oxygen, have recently been changed on the official periodic table of elements. Item number three, scientists report the finding that cichlid fish have 5 different cones for seeing color, the most known for any vertebrate. Bob, go first.
Oh,
awesome.
Oh, boy. All right, new study, but you can become drunk by dunking your feet in alcohol. Your feet are so vascular, and I know that you could use your feet and your hands to make your core temperature really cold or warm. The way they're designed really allows temperature change to be pumped into your body really fast. But alcohol and blood though, I'm skeptical of that one. The atomic weights have been changed. Well, atomic weights. I mean, it's a ratio. So, yeah, I could kind of see how that's not exact. Yeah, I'm not totally against that. And let's see, this last one here. Scientists report the finding that cichlid fish have 5 different cones for seeing color. 5. Now, wait, there's not a lot of color in the ocean. Once you get down about, 50 or 100 feet, a lot of the bright colors are really washed out. Then again, that's why you have lots of bright fish in the ocean, because those colors are so washed out, they're not really noticeable. So I could see how that would be a survival advantage. If you could eke out that last bit of color, you could identify prey a little bit better. So I'm going to go with that one as well. So I will then, by elimination, I'm going to say, because I can't really think of a really good mechanism, I'll say the getting drunk with your feet is fiction.
Okay, Jay?
All right, so the study that demonstrates that you can get drunk by dunking your feet in alcohol. So the first thing I ask myself is, can you absorb that molecule through your skin. And I would say that it wouldn't make a difference if it was your feet or anywhere else on your body. I mean, I know that the skin thickness changes. I know that the lower eyelid thickness of skin is the thinnest on your body. And the thickest is probably your feet, especially, or at least the soles of your feet. So there's really nothing thin-skinned about your feet, number one. Number two, I think that we would have known a long time ago if you could get drunk by having alcohol touch your skin. But the second one, the one about the atomic weights of 10 elements being changed, you know, Bob said that the atomic weight is a ratio. And I just find it so wrong that we would even be rethinking this because, you know, we should know this. This should be something that we have absolute certainty about. But so it's rubbing me the wrong way, too. This one is troubling me a lot. So I'm not so sure about that one either. And then the last one, scientists report that the findings of cichlid fish have five different cones for seeing color. And I really liked what Bob said. How do you pronounce that fish again, Steve?
Cichlid.
Cichlid, okay. Jay. My God.
I heard cichlid, and I'm like thinking cichlids now.
I'm hungry.
But they have five different cones for seeing color. Wow. And I do really agree with what Bob said. Sure, the colors are muted in the ocean. Therefore, they would need to see brighter colors more. That makes a lot of sense, Bob. So I'm gonna say that one's science. Now it's between the other two and the fact that I really cannot even begin to venture into the periodic table and start like making calls on what's going on with that. The only thing I really do know about is that alcohol, really, I'm pretty goddamn sure that we do not absorb alcohol through the skin. So therefore, I think the first one about that is false.
Okay, Evan?
I'm going to take these in reverse order. The fish having five different cones for seeing color. Steve, I recall us talking years ago about birds having maybe extra cones in their vision. And that's why like hawks are able to see things that, you know, human vision can't see. And I think this is along those lines. If birds and other animals with advanced sight have these things, then sure, why not? It was a matter of finding these fish and figuring it out. So I don't think that's implausible at all. The atomic weights of the 10 elements. I think this is also true. I think what's going on here is that maybe they have just worked it out to maybe an extra decimal point, something to that extent. It's probably a very small, very minuscule change. I don't think there's anything earth-shattering here. From those two, really that's all that's left to be fiction is becoming drunk from having one's feet in alcohol for several hours. I've heard of you being able to be drunk in other ways through the body and stuff. I wasn't sure if we were talking about enemas, I think, that one time.
Yep, yeah, a guy died from it.
Yeah, yeah. So, but that's, that's an orifice that goes inside the body and everything. So just having your feet in the alcohol for several hours, I don't think that's going to do anything. So that one's fiction.
Okay, so you all agree that the first one about alcohol is the fiction. So I'll take them in reverse order. Number three, scientists report the finding that cichlid fish have five different cones for seeing color, the most known for any vertebrate.
That's cichlid.
You guys all think this one is science, and this one is science.
Yeah, baby.
So, yeah, I mean, the cones are the light receptors in the retina that see color. The rods are the ones that see in black and white. The number of cones that an animal has will determine how richly and in how much detail and discrimination they see colors. Early vertebrates basically had three cones for seeing different colors. Mammalian ancestors lost one of their cones, so they went down to two. The thinking is that's probably because they were mostly nocturnal, and therefore they really didn't need three cones.
That stinks.
At least we have them.
And then primates, the red cone actually split into two, so we got a third one back. So we have three cones, but we don't have the same.
There you go, Bob.
We don't have the same three cones that our vertebrate ancestors did. We lost one, but then our red cone split into red and green, and then we have separately the blue one.
Well, I wonder what the difference is.
Yeah, but other orders like birds have four cones. They see colors more richly. Right. They also have more range of visible spectrum. They see ultraviolet. In fact, I know we mentioned before that in many species of bird, the males and females are indistinguishable to humans, but to that species of bird, they can see, you know, colorations on each other that we can't see. So they can easily distinguish male from female. For example, the cichlid fish are actually freshwater fish. They're not in the ocean, so they don't get that deep. These are, you probably have seen them. This is a family of fish that is popular among aquarium enthusiasts because these are brightly colored fish. All right, they're pretty. They come in lots of different specific genera and species that have different shapes and colorings, and there are, you know, a lot of different species are very pretty. So they're very popular in aquariums. And typically the males are much more brightly colored than the females, and the females are attracted to the coloration on the male, and the thinking is that the evolution of this fifth cone for seeing color even more richly may be an adaptation that helps, you know, the females distinguish males as good mates. So there may have been some sexual selection going on there. Pretty cool. It's the first vertebrate identified with five cones. Very cool. Yeah, I wonder what the world would look like.
Very cool.
With five different cones for color discrimination.
I think we'll ever have a computer simulation. We'll be able
How
to
could
show?
We see it?
Really?
It wouldn't help. We'd have to jury rig our retinas and
you'd almost have to hack into
your brain.
You'd have to implant retinas in kids at, you know, when they're very young.
Yeah, that's true too.
So that their brain will develop. It's like Geordie LaForge, right? You're born with the visor. You could see neutrinos and crap. You know, stuff that people.
Just silly neutrinos.
Well,
come
yeah,
on.
I know, but you know what I mean.
That was one of the neutrinos.
He had a very
tachyon particles
spectrum of things that he
could
see, but that's because he
very
was,
wide, very wide. Yeah,
he was sort of had that implant from the time when he was very young. I think that's what it would take. All right, let's go on to number two. The atomic weights of 10 elements, including hydrogen, carbon, nitrogen, and oxygen, have recently been changed on the official periodic table of elements. You guys all think that that one is science, and that one is science. It is science.
Yeah, baby. Yes.
And actually, do you know how they changed them? They changed the official atomic weights of hydrogen, lithium, boron, carbon, nitrogen, oxygen, silicon, sulfur, chlorine, and thallium.
So what happened?
It's a range now.
Yes, but you must have read it, Bob. So they changed that it's actually a range of weight rather than a specific number because that's the reality, right? So in real life, the atomic weights of these elements actually do have a range. They're not specifically fixed.
It depends on the provenance of the atom, where it came from. So the cool thing about this is that if you know the specific atomic weight of an atom, then you could also tell, if the atomic weight is X, then it must have come from this source. So it can be very helpful. But, you know, doing calculations, I'm sure, are going to be a little more difficult because, you know, which weight do you use?
Right.
Type of thing. Right. If you've got a range and that's all you have, you got to pick somewhere within that range.
Use the average.
Yeah.
Unless you have the information to know which specific weight you should use, right?
Exactly.
Which means that a new study demonstrates that it is possible to become drunk from dunking one's feet in alcohol for several hours is fiction.
Clee.
So I can take my foot out of this barrel then.
This actually was a Danish myth that was put to the test by Dr. Peter Lomer Christensen from the Hillerød Hospital in Denmark. He said, let's test this myth. I guess he wanted to be a myth buster, as they say. And he got three adult volunteers who took part in this study. They had no history of alcoholism or addiction or any medical problem that would become problematic. And they drank no alcohol for 24 hours prior to the experiment. And then they submerged their feet in a washing bowl containing Karloff vodka.
Karloff.
And they kept it in there for three hours. Right, Boris Karloff vodka.
Yikes, that's a long time to have your
three
skin
hours.
In contact.
They reported no subjective symptoms of drunkenness, and their blood alcohol level did not change one jot. So this Danish myth is busted.
Oh, yeah.
And there you go.
It's a pretty easy one to devise a test for.
Pretty straightforward.
I mean, it has to get in your bloodstream. That's it.
Basically, yeah. Well, Jay, do you have a quote for us?
This is a quote by J.B.S. Haldane. Oh, is this his most famous quote?
No.
I don't think so.
His most famous quote is probably, it's one of those quotes that you're not really sure. It, you know, he probably didn't say it off the cuff, but it was one of those quotes he just sort of, like after the fact, he said that would have been the optimal answer. And so that's kind of what history remembers. And he was
sweet.
He was asked, what could we learn from about the mind of God by looking at his creation? And the answer was that he has an inordinate fondness for beetles.
Ah, yes.
I remember that quote. But, you know, it's probably a little apocryphal.
So what? It's
but
fun.
So what? It's a great quote.
All right, so this is a quote from J.B.S. Haldane.
B.S.
It's embarrassing, boot. My afraid might have been banished. My forgotten their bosses would do terrible things to my terrible things if me going back there. I mean, it's literally like somebody talking gibberish. That is how they wrote Jar Jar Binks' freaking dialogue. I mean,
wow, Jay. Didn't even try to do an accent, did you?
I can't do it. It's gibberish. I read like 10 quotes by this character. It's so idiotic. It's embarrassing. Like some human being sat down and wrote the dialogue that this ridiculous character was going to say.
Yeah, that person is named, last name Lucas, first name George.
Oh, God. It's really stupid. It's horrible.
Awesome.
Anyway.
We're all scarred for life. Yes, go on.
J.B.S. Haldane. My practice as a scientist is atheistic. That is to say, when I set up an experiment, I assume that no god, angel, or devil is going to interfere with its course. And this assumption has been justified by such success as I have achieved in my professional career. I should therefore be intellectually dishonest if I were not also atheistic in the affairs of the world. J.B.S. Haldane!
That's a good quote.
Awesome.
An inordinate fondness for beetles. Okay. And didgeridoos. I think Jay has an inordinate fondness for his didgeridoo.
I know I'm speaking for everyone when I say we all had an awesome, awesome time with our friends in Sydney and going to the conference and experiencing the country and, you know, scuba diving off the reef.
Yeah, Australia was awesome.
Incredible 2 weeks.
Anyway, I'm still jet lagged, but the trip was definitely worth it. So thanks everyone who helped make it
possible.
Rebecca is in fact just getting back, which is why she's not with us tonight, but she'll be back next week. And in 2 weeks, we have the year-end wrap-up episode. I did create a forum thread on the forums for you to give your votes and your suggestions for the best of 2010, the best and worst of 2010. You're going to have about 10 days, you know, until we record the year-end wrap-up episode. So get to the forums, look for that thread. It's under, you know, posts and messages from the board. And give us your feedback on what you want us to remember and reflect upon for 2010. Well, thanks for joining me again this week, everyone.
Sure. Thanks, Steve.
Hey, Steve. Thank you.
And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by the New England Skeptical Society in association with the James Randi Educational Foundation and SkeptChick.org. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at www.theskepticsguide.org. For questions, suggestions, and other feedback, please use the Contact Us form on the website or send an email to info@theskepticsguide.org. If you enjoyed this episode, then please help us spread the word by voting for us on Dig or leaving us a review on iTunes. You can find links to these sites and others through our homepage. Theorem is produced by Kinetto and is used with permission.